Welcome to the Ecclesia Hollywood Podcast. Make sure to visit us online at churchinhollywood.com.
All right, we're in the middle of a series that we're calling I Don't Buy It, and we are facing seven of the most common reasons that people give, oftentimes to me when I'm meeting with them. Maybe you've also faced these or you struggle with these yourself. Seven reasons that people give when they say they don't believe in Christianity or the Christian's view of the world. And whether these are questions that you right now are wrestling with or it's somebody you know, I hope it's been encouraging to hear that the conversation is not over at the point of doubt and at the point of tension, that there are good answers, there is conversation starters, there are ways of navigating through some of the toughest questions of life. And so far we've looked at the God and science tension. Didn't science disprove God? We also, just a few weeks ago, looked at how could a good God possibly exist when there's evil in the world, or we could call it the problem of evil. And then last week, I had a chance to teach us through the confidence that we can have in the resurrection of Jesus Christ, something that the Apostle Paul in the New Testament said is of first importance. If Jesus did not rise from the dead, then all of this is a big fat waste of time. If you didn't catch that podcast, I encourage you to go back and review that. Today, I want us to tackle together a question that might be the last big obstacle for a lot of you or for people that you know. You might believe that there's a God. You might even believe that there is a means by which we can connect with this God. And you might even believe that Jesus is a very good way. He provides a solid way of connecting with God. But the question you have is, how could anybody really claim, especially in this day and age, that Jesus is the only means by which we can know God, the only means by which we can connect with him? Surely that sounds a little too narrow for some of us, or even intolerant. I'm pleased to introduce to you all this morning a man who is going to be unpacking for us this great question, and we're honored to have him with us. Greg Kokel is a Christian author and teacher. He is the founder of Stand to Reason, which is an organization that deals with these biggest questions of life. And if you want more information on Stand to Reason, you can find them easily at str.org online. Greg is the founder and the president of Stand to Reason. He's dedicated his life to the articulation and defense of the Christian worldview. He's also been the host of radio talk shows for over 20 years. He's been featured on the BBC, U.S. News and World Report, L.A. Times. He's the award-winning author of several books and over 180 articles on various topics. He's spoken in over 60 university and college campuses all over the world, and he's even debated the likes of Deepak Chopra and atheist Michael Shermer. He and his wife, Stees, have one son, Dane, and two daughters, Annabeth and Eva. It is Eva. Did I get that right? Great. I'm very, very excited. We're honored to have with us this morning our guest. Ecclesia, please welcome Greg Kokel.
Hey, thank you, Joseph. Thank you. Thank you. Good morning. It is so hard to follow all those kids. Oh, man. And I know how those kids can enchant you, because my son is 31. He's actually my stepson, but my daughters are 8 and 5. I didn't get married till 4 days before my 48th birthday, so I'm an old guy with kids. I had my first daughter when I was 54, my second when I was 57. I'm about 5 weeks from my 63rd birthday, so I need prayer. Now, the girls are good, you know, and my wife's a fabulous mom, and so, you know, this is a time in my life where I want things more quiet and orderly, and if you have, you know the problem if you got little kids, so, but things are going all right. Now, I tell that to people, and they say, yeah, wait until they become teenagers, and I say, if I'm lucky, I'll be dead by then. You know, I got it all worked out. I'm here today because my life has been deeply changed by an ancient teacher. His name is Jesus of Nazareth. And almost 40 years ago now, when I was a student at UCLA, I began to think more carefully about the things that he said about the way the world was, his opinion about reality, put it simply, and also the claim that he made of my own life. And up until that time, I frankly thought I was too smart to be a Christian. And when I began giving Jesus serious thought, though, that changed. And so I decided, after realizing, reflecting, asking a lot of questions, understanding that Jesus got it right, I decided to follow him. Now, that's almost 40 years. It has not always been easy. It's been really hard, actually, much of the time. You ask any Christian who's honest about it and who has walked with Jesus, they will tell you that. But it's been reality. Now, I'm not here this morning to convert you. That's not my purpose. I have maybe a more modest goal. I want to, I want to put a stone in your shoe, okay? I kind of want to annoy you in a good way. I want you hobbling out of here thinking about something that I've said. Some of you, after me saying what I'm going to say this morning, are going to be happy, actually. Some of you are going to be disturbed. Some of you are going to be angry at me. But I figure as long as I'm honest with you, as long as I treat you nicely, and if I get you thinking, then I've done my job. I'm satisfied with that. You're responsible for your own convictions. There has been one thing, the reason I think you might be angry is because, as Joseph put it, there has been one thing that has annoyed people about Christianity more than anything else, and that is this claim that Jesus is the only way of salvation, that no matter how sincere you are with other convictions, no matter how good you happen to be, it isn't going to count. It isn't going to make it. You got to believe in Jesus. And especially in this day and age, this sounds like complete foolishness, stupidity, narrow-mindedness, intolerance. And I think part of the reason people believe that is because even followers of Christ have not been, I think, careful to be able to explain the reasons for this in a way that makes sense to people. Because it doesn't always make sense to them, and it's troublesome for them too. I'll be candid with you. I don't like this claim of Jesus. I don't like that this is part of our message. If it were up to me, if you're basically nice and good and you're basically sincere person, come on down. You can be in my heaven. The problem is, it's not my heaven. I'm not in charge. I mentioned a few moments ago that I was a what? A follower of Jesus. So if I follow Jesus, I have got to tell you what Jesus says about these things. I can tell you what I say about it because he's the one who has the answers. And in fact, he's the one who made this particular claim. So I want to get into this a little bit, and I want to help you see that there is a rationale here. And when you see it, I hope you think that the issue isn't quite as bizarre as you thought. In fact, I think there's a rationale that is very powerful, that would require that we reject the idea that all religions are equally true. Even if mine is false, I would still reject this idea, not based on intolerance, but just on simple math. And I want to explain that to you in just a moment. But before I get going, I think because of the controversial nature of this issue, I want to try to gently remove reactions that people have against the claim that don't help them to address the issue itself. Because the real issue, it seems to me, and this occurred to me even before I became a Christian, the real issue isn't whether or not this claim is offensive. The real issue is whether it's true or not. Don't you think that there are a lot of things that you don't like that turn out to be true? That's the question I want to ask. And so I want to try to remove a couple of common reaction responses to that people give when they hear this claim that I think is going to get in their way of answering the real question of whether it's true or not. And the first one has already been mentioned. But let me get to that through an illustration. Let's just say that you were not feeling well, and so you went to the doctor, and the doctor examined you closely, and his professional opinion was that you had cancer. In fact, it was a very aggressive form, and you were in deep trouble. And if you did not deal with it immediately, you would die. And you said to the doctor in response, "You're mean. I'm going to go find another doctor that's not as mean as you are." Now, what would you think of someone who acted that way? Well, the first thing you'd probably think, if that actually took place, you'd think that's kind of an odd response. Because what matters is not whether, well, it doesn't seem to be a measure of a person's character that they give you an analysis of your physical condition that you don't like. Maybe he's mean, maybe he's not, but you're not going to get at that from his diagnosis. So it seems like the two aren't connected. But there's a second thing that's going to occur to you. If you had a friend that happened to and he responded that way, you would think your friend is foolish. Because maybe the doctor is right. And if your friend goes around trying to find somebody that tells them what they want to hear, and your friend is really sick, then your friend is going to die. Just because he wasn't willing to consider that the doctor was correct. Instead, he reacted that way. Now, okay, there's the illustration. I want to tweak it just a little bit. The Christian, carrying a message that he's been entrusted with, speaks to someone who doesn't share their convictions about Jesus and says that Jesus is the only way of salvation, which is what Jesus told them to say. And the person responds, "You're mean." Actually, that's not the word they use, but it's tantamount to that. They say, "You're intolerant." Now, it may be that a Christian, and many Christians, are intolerant. But they're not intolerant, it seems to me, in virtue of the fact that they are passing on this claim of Jesus. Notice what's happening in that kind of thing. Is the person who is rejecting, even listening because of the alleged intolerance, is changing the subject. The person who gave the message is called intolerant. Notice that the charge of intolerance does not go to the diagnosis, does it? It's simply a character attack on the Christian. What if the Christian were to say in response, "And you're ugly"? Now, I mean, I wouldn't do that if somebody said that to me, but what would be the difference? The first person challenges the Christian's character. They challenge their good looks or whatever, but neither is talking about the issue at hand. They have changed the subject entirely. So I just want to suggest to you that when somebody raises the charge of intolerance, first of all, it doesn't seem to be connected to the claim at all. All right? Secondly, it's just a personal attack on the person. It's ignoring the issue itself. Because it could be that maybe the claim is accurate. So I think this is a distraction. And I want to encourage you not to, this issue is too important to allow yourself to be distracted in that fashion. Here's another challenge that I think sometimes gets in the way. And that is that Christians are narrow-minded. Now, this is based on a confusion or a misunderstanding. There is no question that the Christian view is narrow. And that's because every single claim to truth is narrow. Every single religion that claims to be true is narrow in the claim in that they restrict other points of view. That is entirely different from being narrow-minded. Narrow-mindedness is not a phrase that describes the view. It describes the person who holds the view. That is, a person who is narrow-minded has blinders on, right? They are blind to other options. They will not consider any other alternatives because they're looking like this. Now, it might be that what they're looking, their view is correct, but they can't know that because they have a prejudice towards other views. Are there narrow-minded Christians? Sure, the world's full of them. But you can't know they're narrow-minded based on this claim. You could only know they're narrow-minded if they can give you reasons why the claim is true or not. It may be, and my experience has been, a lot of people who dismiss Christians out of hand based on this claim are themselves the ones that often have the blinders on because they don't want to see if there's any good reasons for this. So this is another objection that I think gets in the way, and I just want to encourage you, don't let it happen to you. Again, the issue is too important. Now, here's what I want to do with the rest of the time. If we can set those stumbling blocks aside for a moment, I want to tell you why I think the claim that all religions are equally true is just simply false. And this doesn't trade on my own personal convictions as a Christian. And then what I want to do is I want to look at Jesus. I want to look at the things he said. I want to look at the historical record to find out why he said the things that he said. And then maybe this issue about Jesus being the only way will make more sense to you. About 10 years ago, I was flown out to Toronto, Canada, and I was asked to do a TV show, which is a nationally syndicated program called Test of Faith. And Test of Faith was this show. It was a religious show, but it wasn't a Christian show. It was a secular show where they dealt with religious topics. And what they do is they fly out some religious weirdo, and they'd sit him in the hot seat, and they would have people come up on the panel across from him at the table and or her, and then beat him up for an hour on national TV. You know. By the way, where do you think Mr. Kokel was sitting in this particular occasion? I was the religious weirdo in the hot seat. Now, what was my unusual religious perspective? My perspective was that I rejected the notion of pluralism. Now, pluralism is the idea, when used applying to religion, that all religions are equally valid. For Jews, Judaism is true. For Christians, Christianity is true. For Islam, Muslims, Islam is true. And across the board, everybody's view is equally true. Such that if you step aside out of that trend, so to speak, and you say, well, you know, I think some people maybe are mistaken on this, then you are publicly labeled as intolerant, narrow-minded, and bigoted, and you know the drill. And so this is why they wanted me there, because they wanted to challenge me on this particular point. Now, on the panel, there was a Sikh. A Sikh is a religious order from India. The gentlemen wear the turbans. There was a liberal Christian from the United Church of Canada. And there was also a Hindu pastor. Pluralists all. Valerie Pringle had me by myself for the first 5 minutes in the opening segment. Then the others came on afterwards. And her whole point was to figure out why I hold this ridiculous idea that pluralism is false. Now, I'm catching myself because there's all kinds of things about this one-hour show that were lots of fun to relate, and they're funny, and they're interesting, but I can't go there because I don't have enough time. Let me just tell you the argument I gave. I told Valerie Pringle that I am going to give an argument against religious pluralism, that is, against the idea that all religions are equally true, that does not trade on my own religious convictions. In fact, even if I were an atheist, I could use this argument if I thought it's possible some religion were true. They can't all be true. Here's what I said. Jesus claimed to be the Messiah. Well, he either was the Messiah or he wasn't. If he wasn't the Messiah, look, the Jews are right on that and the Christians are wrong. If he was the Messiah, well, then the Christians are right on that point and the Jews are wrong. But under no circumstance can they both be right. Do you see that? If there is a God, maybe it's an open question, then he is either a personal being or not. That is an impersonal force of some kind. If it turns out he's an impersonal force, well, then the Hindus are right on that point and the Jews and the Christians and Muslims are wrong. If it turns out that God is personal, then the Jews and the Christians and Muslims are right on that one and the Hindus are wrong, but they can't both be right. When you die, well, I don't know, maybe you go to heaven or hell. Maybe you get reincarnated. Maybe you get taken to astral worlds. Maybe you just lie in the grave, but you can't do them all at the same time. Somebody's mistaken. This is not narrow-mindedness. This isn't arrogance. This isn't bigotry. This isn't intolerance. This is just math. Maybe I'm the one who's mistaken. That's entirely possible for the sake of discussion. I'm just saying they can't all be right. And by the way, we're not talking about how many angels can dance on the head of a pin here. We're talking about the central features of every religion. They are incommensurable. They contradict. This is why I would reject pluralism in that sense, regardless of what conviction I held, because I fancy myself somewhat of a thoughtful person. And if you're a thoughtful person, you can, without hostility towards others who disagree, you could also reject the idea that they're all right. It's not personal, friends. That's not the point. So, That's why I'm not a pluralist. Now, it may be that some religion is true. Maybe none of them are, but it may be that one is. And so I want to talk to you now, since the topic here is Jesus, I want to talk to you about what the historical record says about Jesus of Nazareth. Now, I'm choosing my words carefully because we have a detailed historical record of what happened in the life of Jesus of Nazareth. It's the place that historians go to get their information. It's the place that every single one of you, regardless of your convictions, if you have any beliefs or opinion about Jesus at all, you go to get your information. It's called Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. There's a couple of scattered bits of information in some of the other writings of the followers of Jesus that you'll find in the New Testament, and there's a couple of scattered references, maybe 17 of them, in secular references, but all the details in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, this is what the historians use. It's what I'm going to go to get my information. And what do we learn first from the record about Jesus of Nazareth? Here's what we learn first, and this will stun a lot of you, that it was the identity of Jesus that was the central issue to Jesus. You see, Jesus didn't come to help the poor and to help us to all get along and love and peace and all of that stuff. That was important. Those were involved in his teachings, but it isn't what he said he came to do. From the very beginning, there has been a unified message. I came to seek and to save that which was lost, to give my life a ransom for many. When in the birth narratives, which some of you have just gone over, Joseph gets a dream from God, the vision, and he is told that Mary has a son. It's of the Holy Spirit. Don't worry about that. He will be a savior that will save their people from their sins. That's the message from the beginning. Jesus was the Messiah. Now, that's the important thing that Jesus kept on with. In fact, at one point in Jesus' ministry, towards the end, he said to his own disciples, his own followers, "Who do people say that I am?" And there was various answers. And he said, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter, speaking for them, said, "You are the Messiah, the Son of God." By the way, that's two different things. Messiah and Son of God. And in the parlance of that time, and if you're not familiar with this, you're just going to have to trust me on this. In the parlance of that time, to say you were the Son of God is nothing like what we mean when we use that term now. That meant at that time equality with God. And to make this clear, in other words, Jesus said he was God come to earth in human form. At Jesus' trial, Jesus was not executed for anything that he did, but he was executed for who he said he was. The record of the trial includes a question by the high priest. They could not find testimony against Jesus that was adequate under the laws of that time to convict him under the Jewish laws. And finally, the high priest said this, "Are you the Christ, the Son of God?" And Jesus said, "You have said it yourself, and you will not see me again until you see the Son of Man," Son of God, Son of Man. He's quoting Daniel chapter 9. The Son of Man there was a divine figure coming, and here's how he put it, coming in the clouds with power and great glory. It was a direct reference to that passage, another divine claim. The priest tore his robes, and he said, "What more evidence do we need? He has blasphemed." It was not blasphemy to claim to be the Messiah. They were expecting it. It was blasphemy to claim to be the Son of God. And on the basis of that, Jesus was led off to execution. The central theme of Jesus' life was who he was. It wasn't teachings like the Sermon on the Mount. Those are all valuable. But if you study, you'll realize that most of Jesus' teachings were not original. They were derivative from the ancient Hebrew prophets. Second, what did the record teach about who Jesus was, since that was the main thing? The record taught that Jesus was the Savior, the only way of salvation. Now, some of you might be familiar with John 14, verse 6. Jesus says, "I am the way, the truth, the life. No one comes to the Father but through me." I read an article recently on the internet about a guy just being totally dismissive. That's just your interpretation, Christians. I have an alternate interpretation that doesn't entail Jesus being the only way of salvation. And my response when I read that is, that's not the only place that Jesus said that. Jesus said it over and over and over again. In fact, I have a little red booklet. You're welcome to it. It's out on the table there. It's going to cost you $2 plus probably 20 cents for the governor. I don't care about your $2. I care that you understand what it says. 100 verses that explicitly or implicitly teach that Jesus is the only way of salvation. Because this wasn't just on the lips of Jesus. He who believes in me has life. He who does not believe, the wrath of God abides on him. That's Jesus. That's John chapter 3. That's the great God so loved the world chapter. But Jesus was serious about this. Enter Matthew 7, Sermon on the Mount, first grace discourse of Jesus. He's letting people know exactly how it is. Just listen to his words. Doesn't matter what I think. Listen to Jesus. Enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction, and many are those who enter by it. For the gate is small and the way is narrow that leads to life, and few are those who find it. It's not only Jesus, but every single person that Jesus personally trained to follow after him said exactly the same thing. In the history of the early church, called the Book of Acts, 2 months after Jesus was crucified and rose from the dead, here is Peter, formerly somebody with his knees knocking together, hiding, now having experienced the risen Christ, standing before the very people who crucified Jesus. And here's what he said, there is salvation in none other. For there is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved. Why would Peter risk execution for what he was saying if the Jews were fine with the religion they had? Paul said the same thing. John said the same thing. That's what the record shows. Here's the question that I ask for you. Was Jesus right? Was he right? He could be mistaken. He could have been mistaken when he said he was the only way to salvation, that he was God in the flesh, that he was the resurrection and the life, that he was the living water, that he was the bread of life, that he was the Alpha and the Omega. He could have been mistaken about all those things. That's possible. But think what that would mean. If Jesus was mistaken about these claims, he either knew he was mistaken or he didn't know. Now, if he knew he was mistaken when he was calling people to allegiance to himself, to surrender everything, to walk with him and follow his way, if he knew he was mistaken, then that would make him someone who was lying about the most important thing you could possibly discuss. I just want to ask you a question. I don't know what your opinion of Jesus is. I imagine it's fairly good, regardless of your opinion about Christianity, or you wouldn't be in this building. You think Jesus was a liar? Does that make sense given what you know about the record about Jesus of Nazareth? I don't think he was a liar. That goes against everything he taught. That doesn't fit for me. All right, well, maybe he wasn't lying. He was wrong, but he wasn't lying. Well, if he's wrong and he wasn't lying, that means he thought all these things were true, but they weren't. That he was the living water, the way of salvation, the bread of life, all of that. And pretty arrogant claims when you think about it. Incidentally, when he said these kinds of things, people didn't go, oh, come on, what an idiot. They reacted differently. The soldiers came to arrest him. This is the first time. And they came back empty-handed. And the people said, why didn't you arrest him? He said, no man speaks as this man speaks. So this guy has credibility. If he was wrong and he didn't know he was wrong, that he thought he was God, this guy's certifiable. This guy's out of his mind. Does that make sense to you? Do you think that's a reasonable alternative? That the guy many people say gave the greatest moral teaching of all time, who crazy people read what he's said and it calms them and restores them to sanity. This guy's nuts. If he's nuts, where does that leave you and I? I don't think he was lying. I don't think he was crazy. But if he wasn't lying and he wasn't crazy, then he wasn't wrong. Because those are the only two alternatives. And then we're stuck. Because now we have Jesus, who's not a pluralist in any way, shape, or form. First commandment, I am the Lord your God, you shall have no other gods before me. It's because there were lots of false religions back then and now. But why? Why is Jesus the only way? And here I want to talk about the cross. And I don't know who chose the songs today, Joseph, but that last song absolutely broke my heart. And I do hope, I don't know what the order of service is here, that you play it again so people listen to the words. Because this is what I'm going to tell you about right now. Crucifixion is a cruel form of punishment. It's generally reserved for slaves and rebels. Death is agonizing. It's slow. It happens usually by suffocation as a person hanging from the nails through the wrist. Contracts their diaphragm and they suffocate to death. This is why they broke the legs of the thieves, so they would die quickly. Jesus was already dead at that point. For Jesus, though, the pain of the cross paled in the face of a greater anguish. It's a deeper torment that could not be seen. It's one no camera could ever capture. I don't care what movie you've seen, you cannot capture this, what I'm about to describe to you. It is more excruciating than the nails that pinned his arms to the timbers. It's more dreadful than the lashes that ripped the flesh from his body. It's a dark and terrible and incalculable agony as God the Father unleashed his fury upon his sinless Son as if Jesus were guilty of some immeasurable evil. Now, why punish the sinless one? At the top of Jesus' cross, there was a certificate. It was a record of the crime, allegedly, that Jesus had committed against Caesar. It said King of the Jews, sedition, basically. This was a fairly common occurrence because it was a rap sheet. It indicated that he was guilty of the crime that he was being punished for. And when the punishment was complete, characteristically, that rap sheet would be taken down and a word would be stamped upon it. And it was cancel it out, like you cancel a check. The word was tetelestai, it means paid or completed or done or finished or something like that. Paid for. But the Apostle Paul tells us that in the heavenly realm, so to speak, there was another certificate that was attached to the cross. You can read about it in Colossians chapter 2. And in the darkness that shrouded Calvary from the sixth to the ninth hour, a divine transaction was taking place. Jesus was making a trade with the Father. And punishment adequate for all the crimes of all humanity, and I mean every murder, every theft, every lustful glance, every modest moment of pride, every monstrous deed of evil, adequate for every crime of every man that was ever committed, the Father poured out upon Jesus as if Jesus were guilty of them all. He was not guilty. He was perfect. He had never committed a crime, never violated his Father's will ever, but he submitted himself to this. And in the end, the cross doesn't take Jesus' life. He doesn't die of loss of blood or asphyxiation. When the last of the debt, certificate of debt, when the last of the debt melts away, when the justice of God is fully satisfied, Jesus just dismisses his spirit. He just lets it go. But before he does, one solitary Greek word escapes his lips. Tetelestai. Now you're Bible's translated, it is finished. Jesus wasn't saying, I'm glad that's over with. This was a victory cry. He's saying, it's done. It's paid for. It's all accomplished. It's canceled out the debt of sin. The divine transaction then is complete. And we read about this in a letter that Paul wrote to the church in Corinth. He says this in chapter 5, verse 21 of 2 Corinthians. He, the Father, made him, Jesus, who knew no sin, to be sin on our behalf, so that we could become the righteousness of God in him. You see, friends, that's the trade. We're broken. We're guilty. We're in rebellion. Jesus was perfect. Jesus took all of the punishment that we deserve on himself so he could give us all of his goodness in God's sight. It's been deposited in your account when you put your faith in Jesus. You want to know why Christians around the world from the beginning have been willing to go to their death with that confession? Because of the trade. That's good news. They are clean because of Jesus. He got dirty for them. He took it on himself. It's called the substitutionary atonement. It's called justification, if you want theological words. It's the divine transaction. And this brings us to the real question of any religion. Religions are valuable insofar as they solve the real problem. That means you got to get the problem right, and you got to get the solution right. If you don't get the problem right and you don't get the solution right, you are barking up the wrong tree. Even if you're doing it generously, in good conscience, with sincerity, people suffer from misplaced sincerity all the time. What was Jesus' answer? Well, Jesus' analysis is that the problem is that human beings are in rebellion to God. He made human beings to be in friendship with him. Human beings have rebelled and said, I'm doing it my own way. And you know what they got? Look around you. That's what we got. God is beckoning us back to the proper relationship, which is him as king, we as subjects, him as father, we as sons. That, by the way, is called the kingdom of God. And that looks a certain way. And there's a way to get into the kingdom, and that's you got to deal with the guilt of rebellion first, and that's where Jesus comes in. Jesus is the only way of salvation, my friends, because he's the only one who solved the problem. No other human being did this. Only Jesus. Every other human being is caught up in the problem. They need to be rescued. And I think this is something that deep in our heart we all know. When I spoke at Berkeley a number of years ago, huge auditorium, overflow into other rooms, I was talking about a different issue, but I was ending on this point. I said, there's something I know that's true about everybody in this room that you know about yourself, but you don't like other people to know, and you try to keep it to yourself, but you haven't fooled me. What is that? I said, well, one way of putting it is you have a bad self-image. How do I know that? Because everybody does, including me. The fact is we all look down inside of ourselves, and when we do, we see something in there we don't like. It's twisted, and it's broken, and it's ugly, and we don't want people to see that. We don't want even ourselves to see it. We try to talk ourselves out of it, but we can't avoid it. And then I ask the audience this. When you are aware of your own moral brokenness, there is a feeling that you have that has a name for it in the English language. What is the name for the feeling that you have when you are privately aware of your own moral brokenness? And across the audience, I could hear the word, you might be thinking of it right now. Guilt. 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 This is Cal. It's not a church. Guilt. I said, you're right. You ever ask yourself the question I asked the audience, why you feel guilty? Oh, maybe culture causes it. You know, I guess we can talk about that. But how about this? Maybe we feel guilty because we are guilty. Is that in the running? And if we feel guilty because we are guilty, we've got the problem right. Because that is the problem according to Jesus. Now what? The answer to guilt is not denial. The answer to guilt is forgiveness. And this is exactly where Jesus comes in. Jesus, on a cross, punished for your sin, raised 3 days later for your justification. You can be part of the trade. You can get what Jesus offers if you give him the only thing you have to give, and that is your guilt. Father, this is a hard issue, and even now I feel like I haven't covered it adequately. There's so much more to say. But I only ask that I annoy people in a good way this morning, and I trust that by your Spirit I have done that, and that you will take these words and make them life and truth for those that are here, regardless of which side of the aisle they're on. We need this to be reminded constantly.